they ought to package them and ship them to whatever disposal facility is appropriate, just like anyone else would. This is not material that ought to be dumped on Prince William Sound or some other part of the spill area simply because of it may not be convenient for Exxon to dispose of it. I think they have to do the whole job if we're going to get this job done right.
Despite Exxon assurances to the contrary, the Valdez spill has now moved through Shelikof Strait and splattered beaches along the Alaska Peninsula and Basharoff National Wildlife Refuges. Fish and game biologist Dick Sellers.
You could be on a beach one day and it may not look bad. You could go back the next day and the impacts could be dramatically different. In addition, there's lots of oil and moose out on the water and big flocks of ducks and seabirds out in that stuff. So the impacts are going to be ongoing for quite a long time, I suspect.
The leading edge of the spill was last reported in the Chignik Bay area, the site of one of the state's most highly lucrative salmon fisheries, more than 500 miles from the site of the grounded tanker. Meanwhile, fishermen in Sand Point were preparing to be hit next by the runaway oil. In Dillingham, I'm Bob King.
Chugach Bay, Rocky Bay, and Windy Bay are located on the southern tip of the Kenai Peninsula. The once pristine area is now reeling from oil from the Exxon Valdez. Marge Tillian, who is a member of the Oil Spill Incident Command Team in Homer, is angry that only a few boats are now working the coast of the peninsula. She said there's lots of oil there and it needs to be cleaned up.
The fish streams are being horribly polluted. They do have some booms, but they lack any people on the beaches. They have a few small crews, which are so overworked they can't do much.
Tillian says if Exxon doesn't come up with a better plan by the end of the week, local residents are ready to take matters into their own hands. In Homer, I'm Joe Gallagher.
Health and safety experts say VECO's 1 to 2 hour program does not adequately train workers in handling a toxic substance, nor does it properly prepare people for working in remote sites. According to VECO safety engineer Phil Larson, VECO is looking to expand the program into a 4 hour course. In addition to the basic core program, another hour of training will be geared to environmental conditions specific to each region. The revised safety training is expected to have more emphasis on decontamination procedures along with medical and survival skills. So far, over 2,500 people have taken the short safety training. Larson says all these people will probably have to be retrained. VECO presents its new program to the Department of Labor today. Reporting from Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
The big Russian skimmer slipped into Shelikof Strait sometime over the weekend as silently as the fog. Coast Guard reports today said the skimmer retrieved 63,000 gallons of oil along the Alaska Peninsula side of the strait by 9:30 Sunday morning. Most Kodiak Islanders didn't even know it had arrived. Currents and winds continue to push tar balls and thick sludge onto the entire coastline of Katmai National Park. Katmai hosts the largest protected population of bears in the United States. Cordell Roy of the National Park Service reads from a log of an overflight made yesterday.
Oil beaches were common from Shaw Island to Kashvik. Oil is offshore in varying densities along the entire coastline. Moose was heavy off Katmai Bay. Thick moose with dead birds were observed off Kaipalik Island. Over 500 sea otters and 200 sea lions off Shaken Reef and Shaken Islets. These islets were surrounded by sheen.
Donna Dewhurst represents Alaska Peninsula Wildlife Refuges, or the coastline between Katmai and Aniakchak. Dewhurst says that area is now seeing signs of lots of oil as well.
Yesterday alone, they counted 522 dead oilfowl birds along the southern coast of Alinchak Bay. Picked up two dead sea otters as an adult and a very young pup at Alinchak Bay. At the Kekernoi Islets, which are just on the northeastern coast of Puolli Bay, they had 150 sea lions hauled out on one of the islets. And it was described as they were up on the islets and the islets were completely surrounded by moose.
Dewhurst says they counted 180 otters in Wide Bay, where moose and oil were reported just this morning. Skimming and other cleanup operations were at a standstill today because of heavy fog. Visibility is about 100 yards. The disheartening news doesn't stop there. On Sunday, the entire mainland district, or the western side of Kodiak Island, was closed to herring fishing because of possible oil contamination. And oil boom is en route to Chignik, halfway down the Alaska Peninsula. Chignik is the most exclusive salmon permit area in the state. Reporting from Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
There aren't many places where migrating birds can stop to rest and feed along the Pacific Flyway, but the Copper River Delta is one such place. So are the Mendenhall Wetlands, which for a small sandpiper, for example, is a good spot to stop on its annual journey of thousands of miles. Right now, the flocks of sandpipers, dunlins, and other shorebirds showing themselves on the flats around Juneau are gearing up for the 2 or 3 day flight to the Copper River. And once they get there, they'll feed for perhaps a week, then continue heading north. Don McKnight of the State Division of Wildlife Conservation says these birds may be the lucky ones. They'll use the unpolluted intertidal areas of the Copper River Delta and then head north, spreading out over a vast area of Alaska.
Birds going through the Copper River Delta, depending upon the species and populations of individual species, will go everywhere from Prudhoe Bay from the North Slope, around, all along the coast. And in fact, some of those shorebirds nest in the mountains. They'll nest in Denali Park.
Other migrating birds, less numerous than the sandpiper and the dunlin, may have a tougher time. Already hard hit by the oil spill are thousands of waterfowl that spent the winter in Prince William Sound. Soon, the silence brought by their deaths will be replaced by their migrating cousins.
We're talking some of the duck waterfowl species. We're talking about loons. We're talking about grebes that winter further south and are migrating northward. Those birds actually will attempt to use waters that have been affected by the spill.
And to prevent that, if possible, biologists have begun setting up scarecrows and setting off explosions on the oiled beaches of Prince William Sound. It's not fail-safe for sure. The oil is too extensive for that. But the rafting techniques are about the only weapon available, according to McKnight and other biologists. There are problems with this, though, especially, says McKnight, if the birds do not get enough to eat while they're in Prince William Sound.
The way our timing is up here in this far north, those birds arrive on the breeding grounds ready essentially to start laying eggs. And their energy reserves, that if they don't have the energy reserves when they get on the breeding grounds, it could really have a serious impact on their reproduction.
Besides the oil spill itself, another hazard awaits some birds, those that prey off the dead or the dying. And some of those are endangered species.
The one that comes to mind, the one species that comes to mind, is peregrine falcons. We're concerned about the secondary effects of oil. In other words, raptors like bald eagles, peregrine falcons, and raptorial species eating oiled birds and thereby being poisoned. That is a concern.
Planning Director Don McKnight of the Division of Wildlife Conservation. The month of May is when Alaska's skies are filled with migrating birds. The other time is September, when the flights south begin. By then, it's hoped the worst of the oil will be off the beaches, and Prince William Sound may offer a less deadly stopover for the birds of the Pacific Flyway. In Juneau, I'm John Greeley.
Sally Sedek writes for the Alaska Journal of Commerce. The same company publishes Alaska Oil and Industry News. She says the spill will probably affect the state budget through fiscal year 1991. One reason is rising oil prices. That will make budget cutting easier on the legislature. But another is how many Alaskans will actually get jobs that are involved with the oil spill.
And we're probably heading into another medium-sized boom like we had during the pipeline days. And you just have to look at a few numbers to figure this out. It started hitting us this week. Exxon's going to be employing 4,000 workers over the next few months, and it'll probably be more, and it'll probably go beyond September. If you just calculate their wages at $12 an hour, they're paying average 17, we understand, That's $500,000 a day being consumed at really conservative estimates.
FedEx estimates Exxon will spend $25 million to compensate herring fishermen who weren't able to get their nets out this season, and another $1,500 a day to the mosquito fleet involved in the oil cleanup. That adds another $12 million to Exxon's expenses. And FedEx says the Soviet oil skimming vessel cost about $15,000 a day, and that must be paid in dollars, not rubles.
Animal rescue efforts are increasing with improved success, and I think that that's another, you know, we're going to get some red Adairs out of there as well. That's going to consume several months of activity. Exxon will pay for that. Disaster class action lawyer suits. Melvin Belli predicts that the damages on this will run to $1 billion before it's over. So you add in lodging, air charters, food, supplies, government reimbursable costs. There's a ton of those. Research, Navy ships, and state ferries, they don't come cheap either. More spending impact on retail sales, loss claims, those will add up. I think by the time this is over, we're going to be looking at an expenditure of probably $1 to $2 billion down there.
FedEx says the money spent on oil spill impact will flow into Alaska in a very compressed period of time, a fiscal year, basically.
I think there's some comfort in knowing that it's Exxon that did this.
FedEx says Exxon, the largest oil company in the world and the number three company on the Fortune 500 list, did $79 billion in business last year. It carries $400 million in liability insurance per oil spill.
The point is Exxon can afford to clean up this spilt substance. And I don't like to think of where we would have been if it had been the fly-by-night tanker company or Alpetco that we were relying on, for example, to clean this up.
FedEx says there's not a lot of money that will be spent outside because the spill is here in Alaska, the cleanup is here, and the businesses are here.
That even if they get out of it with $1 billion, that's half of the state budget that's going to be dropped all over the state.
FedEx says the shock of the damage from the oil spill is equivalent to the 1964 earthquake, and the response to it may be the same. Even international teams are coming to Alaska to help. All those people will have an effect, hopefully a positive one, on the state economy. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Robin Martin.
Nader says Exxon should pay for what happened, but it probably won't because the bulk of Exxon's expenses are insurable or tax deductible.
If you take the net expenses after insurance and deductibility of what Exxon spends to deal with the aftermath of this vast oil spill in Alaska, and you deduct it from the increased revenue that Exxon receives as a result of its increased gasoline prices all over the country, it's very likely that Exxon will come out ahead this year from an economic point of view.
Nader says that's where a consumer boycott comes in. Consumer and environmental groups are demanding Exxon take five separate actions. One, pay for all cleanup costs and damages resulting from the oil spill. Two, establish a $1 billion annual trust fund for environmental protection. Three, conduct no oil drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Four, pay for safe oil tankers. And five, roll back recent gasoline price hikes. Nader says then Exxon will feel the economic sting of the Valdez oil spill.
For these tankers.
Consumers are also being asked to cut their Exxon credit cards in half and send them to the public interest group Citizen Action. The group's Ed Rothschild says this should send a clear message to Exxon.
The clear message we're sending today to Exxon and its insensitive and arrogant chairman, Mr. L. G. Rawl, is you and you alone must pay for your mess. You can't make the people of Alaska, American consumers, taxpayers, or future generations pay the consequence of your actions. And even though everyone knows that the Exxon logo is the sign of the double cross, your double crosses must end.
Rothschild says those cut-up credit cards, along with plenty of angry citizens, will show up at Exxon's annual meeting on May 18th in New Jersey. The League of Conservation Voters is asking Exxon stockholders to send them their proxies so the league can vote to make changes at Exxon. Exxon isn't the only one under fire. Conservationists say they're disappointed with Congress and President Bush. Brent Blackwelder of the League.
President Bush said he wanted to be an environmental president. Well, now, the most logical analogy would be Teddy Roosevelt, a strong Republican conservation president, a real leader. Now, ask yourself this question. with this disastrous oil spill, would Teddy Roosevelt have been sitting in the White House, or would he have gone out on the scene and taken a look firsthand and then come forward with a leadership agenda saying that this is never going to happen again, we're going to push something through? No, Bush has sat back in the White House twiddling his thumbs, essentially. And the debate has been around whether Exxon is going to be paying a fair share or get a special break on Interior Department damage rules.
The groups say they don't want to bring Exxon to its knees, but Nader and others say Exxon must be held accountable for the Valdez oil spill. For Alaska Public Radio, this is Chris Kirby in Washington, D.C.
Despite Exxon assurances that it will be highly unlikely for oil to get into Shelikov Strait, the Valdez spill has splattered beaches along the Alaska Peninsula and now stretches as far south as Chignik, more than 500 miles from where the tanker Exxon Valdez went aground. Over the weekend, the Alaska Peninsula south of the Katmai National Park was hit. Oil was spotted along more than 100 miles of coastline, including the Alaska Peninsula and Basharoff National Wildlife Refuges. The Aniakchak National Monument in between the two is also likely affected. Fish and game biologist Dick Sellers flew over the area this weekend and says the oil coverage was spotty.
In some spots it was really thick and, you know, was solid oil. Other spots it was patchy and blotches anywhere from just drop size on up to a foot square. Some of it was like you had a 5-gallon bucket of oil and you had a big brush and you were kind of sloppy on spreading it out along the beach.
As elsewhere along the spill's course, dead wildlife was found even on the lightly oiled beaches, and the impact of the harder hit areas was devastating.
The most dramatic wildlife impacts we noticed on Sunday in the Olenchak Bay, and we had two teams walking the beach and covered about 6 miles of more or less sandy beach in Olenchak Bay and counted 522 dead seabirds and also a mother and a pup sea otter had been deposited there.
Meanwhile, in Chignik, fishermen deployed booms across the mouth of Chignik Lagoon immediately after the first reports of oil came in. The booms were hit by oil less than an hour later, according to Emergency Services Director Ron Bowers. While most of the sludge was stopped, a sheen of oil passed over the booms. Exxon officials have been sent to the Chignik's to contract for the use of vessels. Also on its way is more boom and other equipment, including a skimmer. What's next for the oil? Most likely the Shumagin Islands, and in Sand Point, fishermen are preparing for the next hit. They're organizing vessel owners willing to help with the cleanup or booming efforts. Bristol Bay fishermen, meanwhile, are becoming increasingly worried that their fishery may be affected if the oil hits the Shumagins in June. That's when the Bristol Bay salmon migrate through the area. Though the weathered oil is said to have a low toxicity level, fish could be contaminated and made unsaleable by mere contact with it. After passing through the Shelikov Strait, Tom Royer, a physical oceanographer with the University of Alaska's Institute of Marine Sciences, says the current should take the oil along the Aleutians, though he says the prevailing winds should keep the oil offshore. Some of the oil, though, he says, will probably pass through Unimak Pass into the Bering Sea, where the currents could carry it toward Bristol Bay. Ultimately, Royer says the coastal currents may carry the oil north through the Bering Strait, into the Chukchi Sea, and toward the Beaufort Sea. Ironically, Royer says some of the oil may wash ashore where it originally came from, Prudhoe Bay. In Dillingham, I'm Bob King.
Captain Joseph Hazelwood wore dark clothing and a somber look as he sat silently listening to his lawyer plead not guilty to charges of reckless endangerment, operating a watercraft while intoxicated, and negligent release of oil. His trial date was set for June 20th in Valdez, and his lawyers have talked about asking for a change of venue. Hazelwood's legal troubles may be just beginning, though. Assistant District Attorney Marianne Henry said a grand jury is looking at the case and may come up with more serious indictments. Hazelwood was booked and fingerprinted and released on $50,000 bail. For APRN in Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
I would rather see the governor send somebody back to vote their shares than speaking on the floor. Mm-hmm. That's what I would far prefer. At least this is a response.
Well, you know, you spend a week and a half tying up new ganyons and hooks and sharpening hooks and straightening out gear from last year, getting the reels mounted on the boat a couple days before you have to start chopping bait and baiting everything up. So it, Yeah, you got 2 weeks involved before you go.
Usually around the first month or month before the opening, start working our gear and making sure all the snaps are solid and the lines aren't frayed and the hooks are sharp, so it takes some time.
Wrangell fishermen have differing views on what to expect from the marketplace this year. One fisherman says processors will try to keep prices low because they like to buy cheap and sell high. Another believes the price will go way up due to Southeast's unpolluted waters.
I'll be surprised to see if we see more than a dollar a pound for halibut this year, too. I just, from rumors I've heard and the scare on our seafood locally, Alaska's obviously local to the lower 48. So, no, I don't have much faith in the price this year. I'm afraid it's going to be low.
Last year, the openings were too good and the prices were kind of low. So,
do you think that this oil spill way up north has any effect on how Southeast halibut will sell?
If anything, I think it should make the Southeast products more profitable because our fish aren't, there's nothing wrong with our waters.
The majority opinion on the docks this close to the opening is that it's all a crapshoot and they're just taking their best shot. I'm Zoe Harrigus.
We'll loan either 80% of the purchase price or 50% of the limited entry value, whichever is less. If, in fact, the 1989 salmon season is relatively unaffected by the oil spill, and as soon as we have data to indicate that, then we'll more than likely go back to our regular policies.
The vice president spent about 20 minutes on heavily oiled Smith Island, watching Exxon cleanup crews hose down the beach where they've worked most of the past 10 days. Quail said he's impressed at the level of cooperation among Exxon, the state, the Coast Guard, and other agencies, and he says the White House will continue relying on that partnership throughout the cleanup work. At a news conference at Elmendorf Air Force Base this morning, the vice president was asked if he thinks Exxon's cleanup plans are adequate.
I would say that Exxon believes that it's adequate, but I believe that Exxon's going to have to do more than they think they're going to have to do.
Quayle says the president will rely on him to bring a report back to Washington today, and he says Bush will continue hearing the news from Prince William Sound from his advisors, since the president has no immediate plans to come to Alaska to see the spill damage for himself. In Anchorage, I'm Roseanne Smith.
In papers filed with the Attorney General's office, Anchorage attorney Ronald Flansburg charges that the contract between AVA and Exxon was a collusive scheme designed to short-circuit the state's procurement code and funnel the $4 million contract to one of Holden, Hackney & Breeze's competitors, Bradley Advertising. Commerce Deputy Commissioner Jeff Bush and Alaska Tourism Marketing Council Director Bob Miller agreed that a decision was made not to run the Exxon money through the state because the procurement restrictions would slow the ad campaign down, but they deny there was any attempt to steer the contract to any particular agency. AVA's Dana Brockway says it was simply a matter of time.
AVA has contacted the only agency that it feels could have performed the task and responded as quickly as possible.
Assistant Attorney General Richard Monkman says the state is looking into the charges, but there may not be a violation of the procurement code if state funds weren't involved. For APRN in Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon.
It really does reach across all boards, from regulation to enforcement to adequate prevention techniques and cleanup. So there's no real way, I don't think, as we've approached this, to hone it down to two or three major points. There just really are all different angles that we need to come towards this problem and try to find solutions.
I watched Green Island die. The weather was calm, cold, and cloudy. Shorebirds dodged among the rocks on beaches, searching for a meal. Old squaws, guillemots, and scoters danced on the surf, diving for dinner. Sea otters basked in the sun on their backs, cracking clams open on their stomachs for a tasty reward. Then, the black tide washed in. In horror, I saw the struggle, the suffering, and the fear. Then, helplessly, I watched the dying. The crude oil washed onto the beaches of Green Island in Prince William Sound, March 30th. I went there knowing what was about to happen. I felt like I was going to a friend's deathbed to offer some comfort and company. The terrible thought of dying alone or without someone caring haunted me. Walking the shore, now awash with thick, sticky pudding-like oil, I spotted an old squaw duck. The bird, alarmed and covered with oil, yielded to her instincts and ran for the protection of the now lethal water. I quickly caught her to keep her from diving back into the waves, when I realized something besides oiled feathers was dreadfully wrong. In her attempt to preen the oil from her head and neck, she had ripped open her throat. Her tongue hung out of the opening and dragged along the rocks as she ran. Other birds still out in the oil struggled to get to shore. One bird, on its side with its bill barely above the oil, paddled in a desperate attempt to reach shore, but the oil was too thick. Birds who normally floated high in the water now swam about frantically with their heads barely above the surface. Most of the birds never made it to shore. Even if they did, they would soon die. At the end of a peninsula was a rocky haul-out for sea otters. The first day I saw 7 otters. All wore heavy coats of oil, which looked like hot tar. An otter 5 yards away approached slowly. Falling twice, he rolled against the rocks, trying to scrape the tarry oil from his fur, with no success. When he got to within 2 yards, he looked at me and let out a cry. It sounded like pain, fear, and desperation, but it felt like an accusation. The next day, when I returned to the same spot, all of the otters were gone. They had sought comfort and protection in the surf, but instead found death. Later that day, I came across 3 otters lying on a rocky shore. 2 were already dead. The 3rd, barely alive, lay still with his eyes partially open. His arms were curled in across his chest and his head tucked down. He looked like a huddled child. With his fur slicked with oil, the otter had lost his ability to stay warm. His breathing was erratic and infrequent. I knew I was watching the last struggle of life before the oil and cold took another victim. As I walked back to camp, I almost stepped on a small female scoter huddled against the windy side of a log. I pulled up some dried grass and made a nest on the quiet side. I lifted her up and set her on the grass. She did not fight or struggle to get away. I pulled some more grass and covered her. She put her bill down on the ground to prop her head up, too weak to hold it by herself. I knew she didn't have much time. My hands were oily from holding her. To me, the oil looked like black sticky blood. What, blood on my hands? Sure, I fill my gas tank every week. It seems there's plenty of blame to go around. As I watched this little creature fading from life, her eyes fixed on mine, she seemed to speak to me, saying, "Please, don't let me suffer and die in vain. Tell them. Tell them we are dying in Prince William Sound."
It was called the Oiled Mayor's Conference. Kodiak City Mayor Bob Brody said it was enlightening to compare notes as towns and villages attempt to deal with oil contamination, state and federal agencies, and Exxon. Brody said the group learned many smaller communities that depend a lot on volunteer services, such as firemen and EMTs, are especially anxious. Skilled workers have been hired for cleanup efforts, leaving their hometowns at serious risk. Lack of staffing caused one area's daycare center to close, forcing parents to take their kids to work. In other places, populations have doubled, resulting in a need for extra police, garbage collectors, and the like. And some subsistence villagers are being forced to buy groceries because their traditional foods are befouled by oil. Brody said they learned every community has gotten a different deal. The group will meet in 2 weeks to come up with a standard operating procedure for Exxon and the state. Brody said the most serious concern at this point is a supplemental probation bill stuck somewhere in the legislature. It would provide $40 million to state government to operate in the oil spill situation. The end of the budget year is over in a week, and the bill has yet to be heard. Brody said people are really depending on that money.
If there's anything we could tell you, would be to call Juneau and say you'd like to see this money arrive, no strings attached. They're trying to put all kinds of restrictions on it, and we feel that you just have to trust state agencies to use it in a prudent and equitable manner to get the job done, because you can't predict how to use it any more than we can predict where the oil is going.
Brody said the group spent 2 hours with Governor Cooper and about an hour with Vice President Quayle. Anyone who wanted to got to talk. Villagers were commended in the way in which they identified cultural and subsistence issues. Kodiak's deputy borough mayor, Linda Freed, said Quayle was given a letter stating the group's major concerns. In it, President Bush is urged to initiate a federal buyback of the oil drilling and exploration leases in Bristol Bay. Local governments request a more meaningful role in land use planning and oil and gas leasing processes. The letter also requests at least a 2-year delay in the proposed oil and gas sale encompassing 16.7 million acres of the Gulf of Alaska, Cook Inlet, Lower Cook Inlet, and Shelikof Strait. Both Freed and Brody said everyone at the Oiled Mayors Conference left feeling satisfied with the whole day. Freed said Vice President Quayle spoke with conviction about not forgetting Alaska's needs long after It was called the Oiled Mayors Conference. Kodiak City Mayor Bob Brody said it was enlightening to compare notes as towns and villages attempt to deal with oil contamination, state and federal agencies, and Exxon. Brody said the group learned many smaller communities that depend a lot on volunteer services, such as firemen and EMTs, are especially anxious. Skilled workers have been hired for cleanup efforts, leaving their hometowns at serious risk. Lack of staffing caused one area's daycare center to close, forcing parents to take their kids to work. In other places, populations have doubled, resulting in a need for extra police, garbage collectors, and the like. And some subsistence villagers are being forced to buy groceries because their traditional foods are befouled by oil. Brody said they learned every community has gotten a different deal. The group will meet in 2 weeks to come up with a standard operating procedure for Exxon and the state. Brody said the most serious concern at this point is a supplemental probation bill stuck somewhere in the legislature. It would provide $40 million to state government to operate in the oil spill situation. The end of the budget year is over in a week, and the bill has yet to be heard. Brody said people are really depending on that money.
If there's anything we could tell you, would be to call Juno and say you'd like to see this money arrive, no strings attached. They're trying to put all kinds of restrictions on it, and we feel that you just have to trust state agencies to use it in a prudent and equitable manner to get the job done, because you can't predict how to use it any more than we can predict where the oil is going.
Brody said the group spent 2 hours with Governor Cooper and about an hour with Vice President Quayle. Anyone who wanted to got to talk. Villagers were commended in the way in which they identified cultural and subsistence issues. Kodiak's deputy borough mayor, Linda Freed, said Quayle was given a letter stating the group's major concerns. In it, President Bush is urged to initiate a federal buyback of the oil drilling and exploration leases in Bristol Bay. Local governments request a more meaningful role in land use planning and oil and gas leasing processes. The letter also requests at least a 2-year delay in the proposed oil and gas sale encompassing 16.7 million acres of the Gulf of Alaska, Cook Inlet, Lower Cook Inlet, and Shelikof Strait. Both Freed and Brody said everyone at the Oiled Mayors Conference left feeling satisfied with the whole day. Freed said Vice President Quayle spoke with conviction about not forgetting Alaska's needs long after pictures of dead birds and fouled shoreline have faded.
Basically, the only statement that Vice President Quayle made was that the federal government was in Alaska until this is over, and Exxon is too.
To help overcome the negative perception of Alaskan seafood, Quayle said perhaps they'll begin serving salmon regularly at the White House. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
Admiral Paul Yost wants Exxon to increase its productivity in cleaning up the oil-soaked beaches. After Thursday's visit to Smith Island with Vice President Dan Quayle, Yost was dismayed to find that after more than a week's work, the beaches remained heavily oiled.
That beach at Smith Island is not clean and I can't see when it will be clean. It may be that we have to bypass that beach for 2 or 3 weeks and then return to it. So it's some of the cleanup is difficult to the point that one wonders if restoration will ever be possible. Restoration will probably be done by the Lord in the next few years. I don't think restoration is going to be done by Exxon in the next few months on all of the beaches. It's not possible.
Yo says he told Exxon to continue beach cleanup, but he will have a detailed list of changes needed in the plan by early next week. Exxon could not be reached for comment. Yost also refuted reports that hundreds of miles of beach in the Shelikof Straits and Bristol Bay areas are heavily oiled.
We have a few miles of relatively heavily impacted beach and not hundreds and hundreds of miles of heavily impacted beach. We just don't have it. We're getting a lot of reports of concern, and as we investigate those reports, almost invariably the impact is less than the initial report.
And as to Exxon Corporation President Lee Raymond's remarks Thursday that he wished one person was in charge to approve the final plan, Yost gently reminded everyone that that man is already in place.
In case there's any question who's in charge, Vice Admiral Robbins is in charge, and the president has given me the requirement for personal oversight of this cleanup. So I don't think there's any question on what the mail address is or the telephone number of who's in charge.
Yost will be returning to Washington, D.C. while Robbins remains in Valdez. For APRN in Valdez, I'm Claire Richardson.
It's an issue Alyeska has been fighting with the Environmental Protection Agency and the state for months. EPA has proposed new limits for the amount of oily waste Alyeska can dump into the Valdez Harbor from its ballast water treatment facility. Ballast water is the water the oil tankers use to maintain stability when they're coming up to Valdez to take on millions of gallons of North Slope crude. The state has the power to certify that permit and is attempting to enforce standards three times as strict as EPA originally proposed. Alyeska has objected to the new limits and Friday took its case to court, asking for a temporary restraining order blocking the permit. DEC spokesperson Joe Ferguson says the judge, citing the complicated nature of the issue, held the hearing over until Monday morning. Ferguson called the action legal foot-dragging at the expense of the environment. For APRN in Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon.
The last time anyone counted, tar balls had washed up at about 40 beaches around the island. That was as of a week ago. Bruce Erickson of the Department of Environmental Conservation says he can't venture a guess as to what the number is now. Tar ball cleanup has been given a low priority, much to the dismay of people who will soon be fishing off those beaches. Fisherman Randy Blondin.
These tar balls, the way they are right now, are fairly easy to clean up. I mean, they're like rocks. If they're left alone, they could melt and get into the sand and be more of a hazard later on. I think something like this should be some kind of priority because it won't be too much longer now. And a lot of these gillnet sites are going to be setting up and they're going to have families along these beaches. So I think to those areas, this policy of leave it alone shouldn't be applied because these are more sensitive areas than let's say, Ocean Run beaches where it'll be cleaned up by itself.
Island residents have been told not to collect the tar balls, and up till now there's been no word about what effort, if any, Exxon will make to dispose of them. DEC's Bruce Erickson said today that Exxon will not admit the tar balls are their responsibility.
We're assuming they are from the Exxon Valdez. Exxon is assuming they are not. We are going to be running samples as is Exxon. Exxon has the kits available now, and I believe they are going to be running some samples. So, but that's a controversial question at this time. And we are each proceeding. In other words, this is one area where we've drawn the line. We've thrown the spear in the ground and said, DEC is here, Exxon says we're here. And that'll have to be resolved later on.
In the meantime, Erickson says both sides are trying to resolve the problem for the immediate future. Exxon has agreed to provide containers for the tar balls and will transport the material off-island. DEC will be working with the borough to provide bags to people who want to pick up the tar balls. The only problem is in getting the proper bags. Erickson says there's a shortage right now in North America.
The bags seem to be the glitch or the critical part on this one right now. I think we have a container in Kodiak. We have a place to put them in Kodiak. We had a method with Exxon that they would go out whenever they were passing through the villages to pick these up. We wanted a special color symbol so that if no one was around, they could be at an airstrip or a dock and they could come through and just pick them up and go, you know, this type of thing. And so we're you know, that part is in place. I would say the bags themselves and who's going to administer it in the villages or through the borough will be in place shortly.
Reporting from Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
The MAC team is made up of representatives from various state agencies, including Fish and Game, Natural Resources, and Environmental Conservation. Exxon official Dan Jones caught the committee by surprise when he said the company was planning to cut back on its skimming operations along the Kenai Peninsula coast and didn't plan to deploy any more boom.
The amount of free oil in water is decreasing very dramatically by the day. In other words, yesterday we saw no skimmable oil. That tells us that the need for any more boom is passing, and that we have to report that honestly. If that's our technical judgment based on NOAA spotting, herring fishermen spotting, Exxon spotting, Coast Guard's been up, other folks have been up and are supporting our position that indeed the amount of free oil on water is decreasing. And so it's difficult to go to your more senior management in Valdez and cry for more boom.
Jones's credibility was questioned after it was pointed out that overflights Thursday took place in the Kamishak Bay area and did not include areas of concern from Gore Point west along the Kenai Peninsula coast. Jones also appeared confused about how many boats were working along the coast and where they were located. When he was asked about a request to have Exxon supply a spotter plane to help vessels locate floating oil, Jones said Exxon didn't think that was necessary. His remarks seemed to stretch the patience of the MAC team to the breaking point. No one agreed with Exxon's assessment of the situation. They felt there was still a lot of oil along the coast that needs to be picked up, and that a spotter plane is needed to accomplish that. Homer Mayor John Calhoun has been chairing the MAC meetings for the past several weeks.
It just seems it's the same thing. We're getting jerked around.
Other MAC team members feel the same way as the mayor, but they don't seem to know what to do about it. The Coast Guard is the authority that can bring pressure to bear on Exxon, but up to now, that hasn't happened. Don Segrin of the Department of Environmental Conservation says Exxon has failed to deliver on its promises and is now backing off on its commitment to clean up the oil. Segrin and other agency representatives are openly disgusted with Exxon's performance. The mood at the state headquarters in Homer is grim. Everyone is frustrated with Exxon's apparent decision to curtail skimming and booming activities. Roger McCampbell sits on the MAC team as a representative of the State Division of Parks.
Exxon has the checkbook. There is no excuse to deny what we need. That's a flat-out statement. There's absolutely no excuse to stall or deny our request. There's plenty of materials, plenty of things available for them to carry out our requests. And we're absolutely at the... We've had it up to here with the fertilizer, as Mayor Calhoun made his statement, being dumped back on us. It's double talk. And quite frankly, I think you'll see that most agencies are at their limit with these excuses and stalling practices.
McCampbell says he hopes that the Coast Guard will be able to exert more pressure on Exxon to respond to the needs of the Homer MAC team. Reporting from Homer, I'm Joe Gallagher.
Our law enforcement people have been apprised that there was a number of birds that were collected on an island off of the Kenai Peninsula, brought together and then burned, partly to get them out of the predatory chain, in other words, to keep them from being scavenged by gulls and bald eagles and so forth.
The first bill creates a 7-member commission of scientific experts to investigate the Exxon Valdez disaster and make policy recommendations for prevention and improved response. The other bill on its way to the governor will make it easier for the state to recover the costs of cleanup and damages by putting strict liability on companies that produce, move, use, or store hazardous substances, including crude oil. But another six bills, ranging from tougher penalties to a statewide master plan, have been stalled by members of the House minority who say the bills are vindictive. Republican Terry Martin.
This hysteria of these six or seven bills, whether they're from the Senate or the House, I think it was a rat race between the two groups to find out who can pass the worst bills through, knowing full well that the bills are irresponsible.
But House Democrats say minority members are in the pocket of big oil. A bill that would create tougher penalties for oil spills was severely weakened by the House minority Saturday, and supporters of the measure hope to at least double the $500 million cap on penalties when the bill comes up for reconsideration today. I'm Elizabeth Arnold.
It was called the Oiled Mayors Conference, and it gave them a chance to talk about how towns and villages are dealing with oil contamination, state and federal bureaucracies, and Exxon. Joining the mayors were Governor Cooper and Vice President Quayle. Kodiak City Mayor Bob Brody expressed concern about the legislature quickly passing a bill that would provide $40 million in state assistance. The vice president received a letter stating important requests, among them a federal buyback of oil leases in Bristol Bay and a delay in proposed oil and gas sales in Shelikoff Strait. Kodiak Deputy Borough Mayor Linda Freed said Vice President Quayle spoke with conviction about not forgetting Alaska's needs.
Basically, the only statement that Vice President Quayle made was that the federal government was in Alaska until this is over, and Exxon is too.
Reporting from Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch. Alyeska says that chemical dispersants were supposed to be the first line of defense in fighting a catastrophic oil spill. The state gave approval just 2 weeks before the Exxon oil spill, but Congressman George Miller said that for years the company failed to provide extra mechanical equipment and backup while they waited for dispersant approval.
Until you got dispersants, you didn't change your equipment. You didn't even make the temporary assignment of an additional skimmer, of additional boom, or all of the things you now say you're going to do in response to the emergency plan. See, I'm not so sure that this was a high priority with you folks.
But Alyeska Vice President Theo Palasik said that despite a letter stating the supposedly enormous capability of the company to scoop oil up within 48 hours of a spill, Alyeska never promised it could deliver.
We fulfilled our promises in that plan. We have not broken our promises to the people of this state.
Let me suggest that you haven't, and this obviously is a difference of opinion, but there is no indication that you had any ability to affect the outcome of this spill in the last 45 days. None.
Alyeska officials said they felt comfortable handing over the control of the spill to Exxon within 2 days of the spill. But Miller said despite even stricter response guidelines ordered by the state, he is not confident that the company could prevent or handle another disastrous spill.
I think that's the one that the country is clamoring for, is the notion that somehow this isn't repeated, whether it's 241 years or whether it's next year or whether it's this coast or that coast or this sound.
The hearings will continue this morning with testimony from Exxon and the Coast Guard. For APRN, I'm Claire Richardson in Valdez. Congressman George Miller read from an Alyeska company letter to the state written several years ago. It said Alyeska had the equipment to pick up 100,000 barrels of oil within 2 days of any spill. But Alyeska Vice President Theo Palasik said the letter didn't mean what it said.
Alyeska did not promise to pick up 100,000 barrels in 48 hours. That is some prior correspondence, and that number was asked for and calculated as what the nameplate capacity of the equipment we have on site was capable of.
But Illinois Democrat Richard Durbin said he didn't believe Alyeska.
I believe you've abused the basic trust which was given to your company, which said if you want to do business in this highly technical industry with this potential for disaster, you've got to be prepared to deliver should a disaster occur. You can make all the excuses you want about nameplates and letters that don't count, but the fact is a lot of damage was done when a lot of people thought it could have been avoided.
The state has ordered Alyeska to have 3 large emergency response vessels on hand for future spills, but Palasik enraged Congressman Miller when he said even that level of preparedness wouldn't mean a spill could be controlled.
There's no guarantee. It says we will have that equipment.
Well, and I'm going to tell you, I'm going to leave this hearing and go call the governor, and I'm going to tell the governor, don't do it, because you're running the same path that got us here. There's no guarantee.
The hearings continue this morning with Coast Guard and Exxon officials scheduled to face the committee. For APRN, I'm Claire Richardson in Valdez.
Exxon says the state and Coast Guard dragged their feet when it came to giving permission for the use of chemical dispersants the first few days of the spill. But Coast Guard Port Commander Steve McCall told the Congressional Committee that every test requested by Exxon and Alyeska were approved.
And it was questionable whether or not the dispersants would be effective at all because of the sea state and lack of wind thickness of the oil. The oil at that point in time was still pretty, the thickness on the water surface was still...
It was more than 4/1000ths of an inch.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. They asked for two tests and you said go ahead and do the two tests. They didn't say we'd like to do two tests, now we'd like to do a massive application, and you said no. I mean, there was no request to use greater volumes that you denied.
No, sir.
Okay, so the statement, had we obtained prompt permission to use dispersants, damage from the spill would have been significantly mitigated. They had permission.
Yes, sir.
But Exxon USA President Bill Stevens says even though only a few hundred drums of dispersant were readily available, that would have kept a lot of the 250,000 barrels of oil from hitting the beaches.
Assuming that dispersant would have been applied to the oil through Wednesday and Thursday of that first week as well, gives us a feeling, leads to the calculation that we could have dispersed up to 45% of the oil, and I think a 30 to 40% range is a very reasonable range, Mr. Chairman.
What supports that assertion?
Technical expert calculations.
Otto Harrison, Exxon's top man on the oil spill, insisted that sea otters were being taken care of at an otter facility in Seward, but Congressman Richard Durbin of Illinois disagreed.
There has not been a shortage of facilities to handle otters.
I can just tell you that the information given to us by people who have just returned from Seward and also from Congressman Vento is in direct contradiction of what you've just said. And I would just join my colleague, Mr. DeFazio, in the hope that before this day is ended, that Exxon can give us an adequate response to this question and some evidence as to which side is correct.
Actress Loretta Swit, representing the International Fund for Animal Welfare, says she was in Seward and no otter center exists.
There have been delays, there have been lies, there have been all sorts of stories. We still don't have one. The otters that we have rescued, which are like, I think, 40 or 44 in number, are at the Rehabilitation Center for Birds. The otters need a place to go, to be cleaned and rehabilitated.
The Coast Guard suggests 8,000 workers are needed to clean the beaches by September. Congressmen said they don't think Exxon will be able to do the job by then. And Committee Chairman George Miller says Exxon should be warned that America won't tolerate another oil spill disaster.
If the public cannot be comfortable on the coast of California, the coast of South Carolina, or I guess some parts of Florida where drilling is looked at, or up here in Bristol Bay, in Prince William Sound, if they can't be comfortable that these spills can be responded to on a timely and effective basis, and that's just on that basis, I don't think that they're going to buy into the notion that we ought to expand the risk and expand the opportunities for failure. You know, somebody said it's one in every 241 years, or it's one in a million trips. It turned out to be one in 8,000 or something. I don't think people are going to roll the dice that way with the environment.
In Valdez, I'm Claire Richardson.
The crowd met on the Ellipse, just south and in clear view of the White House. They stood in the damp, chilly air to hear angry, passionate speeches blasting Exxon and describing the havoc wrought on the Sound and its wildlife. The words were made real by a large slideshow. Environmentalist Jan Hartke, with a group called Earth Day 1990, led the barrage against Exxon. He accused company officials with being more concerned about public relations than policies that led to the spill.
The dead otters, the dead birds, the disrupted fishing, the people whose ways of life in Alaska have been forever disrupted, they don't understand that kind of talk. And you have to wonder where the values are of modern corporate America when you have that kind of response. Make no mistake. The issue in Alaska is not a sea captain drunk on booze. The issue in Alaska is a corporation drunk on greed and an American political system that is drunk on big oil money. That's the issue in Alaska, and that's what we're here for here today.
Michelle O'Leary of Cordova District Fishermen United told the crowd why she and other fishers are worried and working hard to mitigate the oil spill damage.
We're upset because it's our front yard. We live, we eat, we cohabitate with the critters that are out there. We make our income, we make our living from them, but most of all, they provide us with a lifestyle that we love, and because we love it and we love them, we feel it's our responsibility to try and protect them and to help save them from this disaster.
O'Leary said the most gripping example of the damage is the oil spill's effect on sea otters. She said the message struck home when she visited a cleaning station.
And I have to tell you that my heart was ripped open when I heard the screams of those sea otters that had oil all over their bodies and were in a strange and terrifying new environment as they suffered. I have a good friend that's always been sort of pro-industry. He's also a fisherman. After spending 2 weeks out on the Sound and picking up many dead sea otters, he said, you know, I've always called those guys, those environmentalists, tree huggers. But, you know, after watching these sea otters out here, I think I just became one of them.
Other speakers, such as well-known environmentalist Barry Commoner, used the spill as a broadside against the country's dependence on oil.
There's no way you can run ships without getting into trouble. There's no way you can have that much oil around without killing wildlife. We have got to declare not that the disaster is a way of telling the oil companies to straighten out and do the right thing. We've got to declare that this disaster is the beginning of a historic transition in which we will wipe out the use of fossil fuels, stop the oil industry, and build a new way of producing energy.
The memorial service closed with meditation and a candlelight vigil. The Washington ceremony was one of 11 held in the lower 48 on Sunday. In Seattle, Denver, Salt Lake City, Atlanta, Chicago, and other cities, there were events ranging from a healing dance to a requiem or a service for the dead. For Alaska Public Radio, this is Joel Southern in Washington, D.C.
We saw a large, massive SNCC just about both south and west of Gore Point, about 11 miles at 0430 Friday morning on our way in.
The International Halibut Commission's chartered vessel, the Royal Quarry, just pulled into Kodiak today. During the past 2 weeks, its crew fished for halibut in areas where there was concern about possible oil contamination. Commissioner Don McCoffrin was pleased to pass on the good news he had just received.
The word we got by telephone is that we found no fish that were affected by the oil whatsoever. And we didn't find any oil on the bottom in Prince William Sound. We were able to fish there and catch halibut, and we saw no effect of the oil on the fish at all.
During the test fishery, tissue samples were taken. They'll be analyzed, and results should be available in about 2 weeks. But McCoffrin said visual inspections indicated the fish were just fine.
The halibut looked fine. They smelled fine. There was no oil on the gear. There was no oil on the bottom. And we fished Prince William Sound up the coast, went up to Barron Islands, and went into Cook Inlet, and all those areas that had a lot of oil. And you can pick them up if they're contaminated. They usually smell of oil. So there was nothing like that. We saw no evidence whatsoever of the effect of the spill.
So at least for Alaska's halibut fishery, worries about product quality can now be put to rest. Reporting from Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch. So far, operations along Katmai National Park have involved picking up dead wildlife and trying to deflect oil from the shore. But now, after a visit from Vice Admiral Clyde Robbins, Exxon plans to put beach cleanup crews on Katmai.
The Admiral was emphatic. He wants something done. He wants action taken. He has ideas that he had himself. He was listening to the ideas that the Park Service, the NOAA people, DEC, and the Coast Guard had as well. And consequently, because of that, I believe there's been a sort of a re-emphasis on action at this point.
Ray Bain is superintendent of Katmai National Park. To avoid harming the shore, Bain says they plan to institute passive beach cleaning, which means cleaning by hand rather than using heavy machinery or high-pressure hoses. According to Exxon spokesman Dick Dorney, two vessels carrying a 20-person work crew will be underway by late today.
This is the beginning of a fairly significant effort, and we will be manning up to deal with this. as we go along. Right now we have a 178-foot dragger processor that will act as kind of a quarters boat and an operations base. Another 108-foot vessel that will serve as sort of the command facility and transport the EMT and the Park Service personnel, our supervisor, and provide additional berthing if we have anybody that needs to get out there.
Dorney says there won't be any large floating hotels for workers because sea conditions in the Shelikof Strait are much rougher than Prince William Sound. The Shelikof has extremely strong currents, big winds, and wave action can go from dead calm to 9-foot seas within minutes.
So we are very cognizant of those limitations. So we're using these smaller boats that we cannot put as many people on, but we'll be using a number of them. And putting our hands on that kind of equipment is going to take a little bit of time, but we're moving forward on that.
Sea conditions in the Shelikof aren't the only safety hazard. Park Service observers have been finding quite a bit of dead wildlife, and wherever there's carcasses, scavenging bears have been found as well. Sunday, a wildlife pickup crew had a close bear encounter, but armed rangers were able to scare the animal off. Ray Bain says bear protection officers will be stationed with the working beach crews. While beach crews are warned to steer clear of the bears, the National Park Service wants to get their hands on a few of them. Bain says they plan to put radio collars on a select number of the coastal bears.
And then being able to track them, radio track them using aircraft, where we can fly over, find those animals, see where they are, if they've died, and we can land, take tissue samples, see if it's been oil-related, if we can get females in particular, and follow them through a couple of seasons when they go into the den and come back out, and particularly if they're pregnant, to find out if there's going to be any impact on fetus survival or if it's going to have an impact on fetus, the development and the early development of the cubs. That's extremely important.
Bain says the Park Service hopes to use similar techniques to track other wildlife, including wolves, foxes, and eagles. In Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
That's the state of the art. I mean, that's it. I mean, because I, you know,